And so we spent that night in this trapper's cabin, and he fed us stew and tea. I think we might have had a whiskey at night, you know, and in our tea. And the next morning, Henry got his dogs going. We had a nice breakfast, and we hit the trail, this windy, meandering, you know, trail through the trees. And I'm in the sled, and then Henry stops the sled, and he says, okay, it's my turn to rest. And so I'm finding myself mushing these dogs. You know, I knew nothing about mushing, and I can barely hold on, and you're standing on the runners and trying to hold this thing. And luckily the dogs knew more about it than I did.
They knew where they were going, I'm sure.
They knew where they were going. They'd done this route before. So, but all those experiences, like, just absolutely pivotal.
Hey guys, what's happening? Welcome to Your Forest. My name is Matthew Christoph. On this podcast, I talk about the environment and the science of sustainability. And today's episode was a really, really special episode for me. I really enjoyed it. Bruce Masterman is a journalist and author. He's written for all kinds of numbers of newspapers and outdoor magazines and all kinds of stuff. And he recently, you know, I think it was 2017, he released a book, which was an amalgamation of a bunch of stories that he had written over the years that he thought were very important to him. And he put them all together into one book called One Last Cast, Reflections of an Outdoor Life. And my wife picked it up for me when she was in High River. He lives in High River. And so he spends a lot of time talking about, you know, the Calgary area and, you know, the Kananaskis country and that kind of stuff, hunting, fishing, hiking, snowshoeing, just generally enjoying the outdoors. And it's an incredible book. I really, really enjoyed it. I don't read a lot of outdoor stuff for some reason. I don't know why. but this one I really appreciated. I found myself reading a chapter, which is its own individual story. And every kind of night before I went to bed, and just kind of left me feeling good and reflecting on my own experiences, my own memories of the outdoors. And yeah, it was just awesome. I really appreciate it. And you guys are going to love it too if you check it out. Check it out. One Last Cast, Reflections of an Outdoor Life by Bruce Masterman. And yeah, this conversation was incredible with him. It was so easy to talk to him. So it was just back and forth as if we were a couple of old friends, you know, having a couple beers and just shooting the bull with each other. It was great. I think you guys will love it. I know I really enjoyed it, and I can't wait to meet up with Bruce again sometime in the future, because just an awesome guy. Awesome, awesome guy. And yeah, that's pretty much it, I guess. Sponsors. Sponsors for this episode, West Fraser is the number one sponsor for 2019, and I couldn't thank them enough for their support. It's made this possible. All kinds of awesome stuff has happened because of that. The reach has nearly doubled this year because of their support and funding for advertisements and for all kinds of different stuff. And I really, really appreciated their help. It really helped with getting the message out. And secondary sponsors, Greenlink Forestry, they provide the space and the opportunity to do this in a real way. And again, they've been a sponsor since the beginning. Can't thank them enough. And DamageTimber.com. Damaged Timber is an apparel company. They work out of Edmonton, Alberta, and they are supporting environmental sciences through the sale of their clothing. So 10% of everything they sell goes towards an environmental sciences scholarship. And yeah, you can apply for it on their website, DamageTimber.com. And yeah, they have awesome clothes, really cool hats, toques, t-shirts, hoodies, all kinds of neat stuff. Check them out. And 10% off if you put in Your Forest 10 at checkout. So yeah, thanks a lot, guys. And without any further messing around, let's jump into it. Listen to this awesome conversation with Bruce and I, just really just talking about the things that we love about the outdoors and why it's important. And I think a lot of people will get something out of it. It'll bring up some memories that they've had themselves and what's really important about it, you know? So, yeah, here we go. And we're recording. It's just like that.
Okay,
so,
perfect.
Yeah. Well, hey, first of all, thanks for making the time. Obviously, this has been a long time organizing, but I mean, it's busy, right? People got stuff going on, and it just happens.
I really appreciate the opportunity to talk about the book, and I've listened to some of your podcasts, and they're great.
That's awesome.
They're very technical. I'm not a technical person in the least, so I felt a little bit intimidated by that, but you just kind of had a very natural and relaxing way of getting people to answer the questions that you ask and some that you didn't ask. So So it's an honor to be here.
That's awesome. Thanks, man. I appreciate it. Yeah. It's interesting. There's not, I try to make it, I don't know what I'm doing when it comes to this thing. Like it started so organically that I never really knew what I wanted from it or what I was trying to do with it. I more just wanted to talk to interesting people about the stuff that I was interested in, right?
Exactly.
And I think I try to make it so that people who aren't in the industry or whatever can understand it, but it doesn't always work. Sometimes I get into the jargon and forget what's going on, right?
Well, I'll try to steer clear of the jargon.
Yeah.
Because I don't know a lot of jargon.
But yeah, I appreciate you saying that. It means a lot. Yeah, when I first got the book from my wife, she sat on my nightstand for a couple months after Christmas, and then as soon as I started looking at it, it was very evident to me. I don't read a lot of outdoor stuff. Like I read a lot of, I find myself trying to like further my own ability and understanding of the world, but I don't read a lot of leisure stuff now anymore for some reason. I used to read used to crush Harry Potter, used to crush Lord of the Rings, all kinds of things.
Right.
Used to love it, right? And I never really got into outdoor reading until I read Sand County Almanac.
Yeah.
Right. And Sand County Almanac is great. Like all the Leopold, obviously, right? But your book was the first book that I read that very immediately I was like, oh yeah, this guy gets it.
Oh,
this guy knows what's up,
right?
Like it was, what I found interesting, I think it was probably by the time, I think it was the nature chapter, so 20 pages in or something like that, when I really, I was like, I got to get this guy on, right? Like it's something about, I found myself appreciating the ability to, first of all, experience nature, right? Whether you're hiking or fishing or whatever you're doing, not just experience it, but really paying attention to the small everyday details of the things that the mundane, right? The thing that people think is, but that's what makes the whole picture, right?
Right. And yes.
Not only being able to experience it, but being able to bring up not just what it's like, but what the emotional connection is like and how. So as I was reading, I found myself very much so thinking of, like, you know what I mean, getting pushed back into my own similar memories and my own emotions and my own, it was exactly like what you had said in the foreword, right? Like you're like, I hope this brings up your own memories and your own, and that's exactly what happened. I just immediately was just like, every chapter I read, I just stopped, and I would usually read one chapter a night just because I wanted to just sit and be happy and reflect on that thought. I'm like, oh, that's nice, I like that, and that's good, and then I kind of savored it for a while, right?
Oh.
It was interesting because it's not like it's technical writing. It's not.
No.
Like it's just very, very pragmatic. Like you're laying your heart on the page, right? You're like, this is what it's like for me. But I don't think most people have the ability to recognize that, or they have too much ego to be emotionally available. You know what I mean?
Yeah. I don't know. I think you have to be honest. You have to be honest to yourself. You have to be honest to the creatures. You have to be honest to the friends that you talk about. You have to be honest to the experience, and to do that, you have to explain and describe the whole experience. And as a writer, it's that's always been a challenge, and it's something I really enjoy doing is bringing people into my writing rather than just saying, you know, this happened. I want to be able to bring the reader there so he or she can sort of feel this happening and can identify with it happening.
Yeah.
And what you just said, Matt, about bringing out your own experiences in my writing, that was definitely my my goal, and it was to get people to go back to, oh yeah, you know, I remember when something similar happened to me, mm-hmm. or that time that I stopped hunting, even though there was lots of daylight, but I'd had a great day, and I couldn't improve on it by shooting an animal, or taking an animal or a bird or whatever that, and not everybody gets that, and so many people are in fishing and hunting and hiking and almost anything related, they're result oriented, and I've never been that way. I love to catch fish, and I love to take game home for the freezer and to help feed my family, and I love all that, but if I don't, so what? Yeah. I've had a great experience, mm-hmm. and I really wanted that reflected in the book.
Oh, you did it! You did it big time. It's funny that you say that, because I'm definitely consider myself one of those, like, I say those things, right? I say hunting is hunting, whether I get something or not, and like, do I really believe that? It's like I want to be in the bush, and I enjoy the experiences. I've had so many, like, obviously more days in the bush, unsuccessful in quote unquote as far as getting an animal than successful as getting an animal, but I've learned more in the days I didn't get something.
Yes.
But all that being said, I still remember, not even, I think it was 6 or 7 years ago, walking into elk camp for the first time, which was my my father-in-law and his friends and family. They had this elk camp they always had, and they had always invited me, but I could never make it for whatever reason, X, Y, and Z. And I got there, and they're all, they're just there for the camaraderie, and they're going to hunt, of course, but they're there for the fun and the relaxation and enjoyment. And I'm coming in with piss and vinegar, 23 years old, 24 years old, just kind of like, I'm not here to see you. I'm here to shoot an elk. And it was just this. And after I said it, I was like, that was gross. I was like, that's what, like, immediately in my head, I was like, that was gross. Like, that's not what this is. And I recognized it immediately, but I was like, I hold myself when I am results yeah. oriented, right? Like, I do feel that I am more fulfilled when I have results, but I feel this past year, especially with the birth of my daughter, I found it's less so.
Yeah.
And now I found myself, I'm taking friends out and that kind of stuff, and I'm getting more enjoyment out of their experience and their learning and their success than I am out of my own. Although one driving factor is meat in the freezer. Definitely need to get more of that.
Yeah.
But it's, yeah, I think that results oriented thing, and I think it's driven, speaking for myself at least, I think a lot of it is driven by the ego more than it's driven by the desire for enjoyment sometimes when you're that way, my buddy shot this and I'm not I can't be the dumbass who didn't get anything, and it's this weird we can't allow ourselves to just enjoy the moment. Like, I think that's really common. So to find somebody like yourself who's truthfully, like, you're really enjoying, and of course I'm sure you appreciate when you get an animal, I'm sure you're ecstatic.
Oh, like everybody else, I definitely do, yes.
But to really go home and go, that's okay. Like, this was incredible. And it comes out in your writing because of the small details, the things that you don't, like, everybody that spends lots of time in the outdoors knows, but they don't necessarily recognize they know.
Yeah.
And then you write about it, and you're like, oh yeah, that is cool. Yeah. The little things, like, so like, one of the things I wanted to ask you was about between, like, you and your and other writer friends, outdoor writer friends that you have, do you think there's something, how can we get people to take in nature the way like an outdoor writer does? Because you guys seem to be very, like, really paying attention in a way that you get so much more out of it, right?
Yeah, I think it's just about opening your mind to the experience and opening all your senses, mm-hmm. and just taking in everything around you, and the little things, seeing a little insect crawling on top of the snow mm-hmm. when there's 3 feet of snow and you haven't seen a bug, for 2 months, and suddenly, what's this thing doing here? And what is that? And how can it live? And where does it go? And when the snow melts, where does it go then? And And what's it eating? You know, like you just kind of you know, get into this whole wondering. Like I'm 67 years old and I feel like a kid every time I'm out there because there's something new happening and I'm seeing things. My wife and my daughters always they when they drive with me, I stop and I look at a deer and they say, "Dad, you've seen deer." I said, "But I've never seen this one." And even if they say, "Well, actually, yesterday when we were driving along here, I think that was the same one." I don't care. I didn't see it. You know, I'm seeing it today now. So,
wow.
And it's just, and I think so many writers get into, and so many editors demand this as well. The, you know, how to, you know, how to shoot a bigger buck, how to catch more fish, you know, how to do this and how to do that. And what I was kind of trying to do and what I've always aimed to do in my writing is not how to, but more why to, yeah. Why do we do this? And to explore that and not every outdoor writer actually, you know, looks at that. And, I remember years and years ago, Matt, I was hired, as a freelance writer to talk to, a corporate group on one of these motivational days that they, yeah. You know, get out of the office and they bring speakers in to talk about things. And there were two writers that they invited, another outdoor writer who I won't name. But very competitive, a tournament fisherman, but very competitive,
yeah.
And me, and I asked, you know, this guy if he wanted to go first, and he said, "No, you go ahead." And so I went ahead and I did this slideshow, and I had pictures of fish and streams, and I had pictures of bugs, and I had pictures of trees, and just people having fun, and sunsets and on the water and stuff like that. And yes, I had some pictures of fish being held, mm-hmm. but that wasn't the emphasis. And the emphasis of my talk was, there's more to fishing than the fish.
Yeah.
It's like Lance Armstrong's, this isn't about the bike, you know, to me, it's not about the fish, the number of fish you're catching. Mm-hmm. So this other guy, so I finished, and, you know, lots of applause and the other guy stood up and he said, "I'm not like Bruce at all."
Yeah.
He said, "I've got to catch fish and I've got to catch big fish and I've got to catch lots of fish." And he said, "I don't look at this other stuff." Mm-hmm. And very well respected, but you know, we just have different ways of looking at things. And I think that holds true for anybody involved in any aspect of the outdoors. We're all different. Mm-hmm. And I don't think I'm any more special mm-hmm. that I do this. People read this book and said, "Bruce, I didn't know you were such a lousy shot," you know, or that you weren't that good of, you know, a fisher. Like, you know, we thought you killed everything you ever aimed at and caught every fish. And,
yeah.
And now we find out that, you know, really you're, you know, kind of not that great at some of this stuff. And I'd say, well, I'm glad you got that impression yeah. because I've never held myself out to be an expert. I'm a writer, and I happen to be a writer who fishes and hunts and hikes and snowshoes and just loves being out in the outdoors, mm-hmm. and I relish that.
Yeah.
But no, I'm not a professional hunter. I'm not a professional angler. So yeah. it's just kind of how you decide to look at things.
For sure, it is.
And I'm probably just rambling now.
No.
But Matt, but you know, it's I've always said that. You don't really appreciate the outdoors until you've seen them through the eyes of a child, you know, and you know, being a new dad, what that's like. I mean, I had and still have two wonderful daughters who we spent a lot of time when they were growing up and before they really got settled in their lives, you know, a lot of time out there, you know, fishing and hiking and, mm-hmm. and cross country skiing and snowshoeing and they would see things differently than I would see them, you know?
Yeah.
And they would see a different pattern in the snow or they'd see they just had a certain way of looking at it.
Yeah.
And
that innocence, right?
And innocence.
They're not spoiled with the view of the ego and the societal pressures that make you want to like certain things over others, right?
Yeah, very much.
Yeah.
And and Karen was the same way. My wife's the same way. And you know that you know, she's always seen things that I didn't notice. And that's so neat about all three of them, you know, Chelsea, Sarah and Karen is that they all see things that I didn't see, and I see things that they didn't see. Mm-hmm. And and that's the beauty of the outdoors to me, totally. is we all see things differently.
Oh, I can relate to that. Just this past summer, we've had an unusual number of slugs in our backyard, right? And I'm going through, I'm like, oh, look, slugs. And I kind of watch them and they go, oh, yeah, they're neat or whatever. My wife was just fascinated by them. Like she would spend, every time she got in and out of the vehicle, she'd be looking and just like watching them and just watching them eat, watching them move, watching them whatever, right? Just totally fascinated. And I'm like, it would never occur to me to be blown away by that. But it is. It's like, you think about like, where do they go? What do they eat? How do they, like, you know what I mean? Everything, right? And it was, and so that I found myself sitting in the backyard having a beer or whatever, and then sitting there watching the slugs do their thing, right?
Yeah,
like, this is incredible.
Yeah,
it's like it's
and it's
funny.
Right in your own backyard,
literally my backyard. Yeah, yes. But it's funny, like the everything you said about the like the how to versus the why to, and then the gentleman who spoke at the conference versus yourself, and I think the gentleman who spoke is more the norm.
Yes.
Right? I think, but I honestly think, I can speak for myself at least, I think that's our ego talking.
Yes.
It's our ego. It's not that, I don't think that guy's getting the most enjoyment out of his time than you are. I don't think that's what's happening. I think if he goes home without catching the biggest or the most fish, he's upset and frustrated and is not going to stop thinking about it until he gets out next time and completes that task. Whereas I think you go home and you go, that was nice. Like I look forward to doing it again, and I appreciate it. And that is rare, I think. I think we, as outdoorsmen or outdoors people, I should say, we say those things. We say it's all about the experience, all about the this and that, and the other thing. But that ego, it plays a dirty role in making us want the result.
Yes.
Right. So I appreciate someone who can step aside from the result and appreciate for everything for what it is, right?
Yeah.
It's hard to do. And so it's but yeah, that perspective thing and getting new people into it, and yeah, it's all so awesome. No, it's
letting the ego take over as well is dangerous ground. Yeah. You know, that's what leads to so many of our hunting infractions, fishing infractions.
Yep.
You know, people get carried away. Well, okay, I know that buck is on the other side of that fence, and I don't really have permission to be there. But on the other hand, what's to say he wasn't over here when I shot and then he jumped the fence? What's to say is your conscience. You know.
Oh, yeah.
You know, you know. And it's like, you know, although Leopold wrote something about, you know, your hunting ethics and it's what it's or your outdoor ethics in general. It's what you do when nobody's watching.
Yeah.
When there's no witnesses. You know, the decisions you make. Mm-hmm. And that I've certainly found in the people that I've, you know, a lot of people I've known who hunt and fish and who have gotten into trouble, it's because they let the ego carry them away.
Yeah.
And it's not good. It's not good for them. It's not good for other outdoors people. And well, it's certainly not good for the resource when that happens.
It's not good for anything,
yeah.
Right? Like it's feeding your ego is never a good call. Like it's always, it's never going to make you happy.
No,
it
never.
Might make you, it might give you some, what you think of bragging rights or look at how awesome I am in the eyes of your friends.
Exactly.
Or whatever. But it's not making you happier, because if you know that you poached that animal,
yeah,
like you know in your conscience that was the wrong thing to do, but if you're I guess if you're unethical, it doesn't matter. But I mean, but like you said, the ethics of it, it's easy to blur the line a bit, right, when it comes to that kind of stuff, if you don't have that solid understanding of like, no, this is fair chase, this is, you know, it's tough.
Yeah. And we face these things like every time we go out. There's
time.
Something like, there's a story in the book, Matt, that Very true story. You know, I went out one morning by myself, 30 below, 3 feet of snow, and I was actually hunting whitetails, or I was planning on going into the forestry, which I had to cross this piece of private land that I had permission to hunt on to get to the forestry to hunt whitetails. And I'm still on the private land, and I'm slogging up this big hill, 3 feet of snow, in full snow camo, and three elk run out in front of me in a field that separated, that led to this, to the public land, but they were on private land, and three elk, three bulls ran out, and I'm all by myself, and one made the mistake of stopping 214 yards. I measured it after. I didn't have a ranger with me, but, or rangefinder, but I shot this elk and he ran downhill, which is always, you know, a encouraging sign when they run downhill rather than uphill after you've shot. But I didn't know that I'd hit him. Like he didn't really respond. And he ran and he disappeared in some willows. And I'm watching these willows, and the willows kind of led to the crown land, but also came back towards me and around me.
Yeah.
And I thought, well, I'm going to give him at least half an hour, and then I'll go and see if he's there. And I'm standing there, and I looked, and I don't know what made me look, but I looked to the east of me, and here comes an absolute wanker bull. Biggest bull I've ever seen outside of a national park.
Yeah.
And he's walking along a fence line 200 yards from me.
Yeah.
And he's heading towards the crown land. But he's on property that I can hunt.
Yeah.
And I'm looking at him, and he doesn't know I'm there.
Yeah.
And I'm looking at him, and I'm looking over at the willows, and I'm thinking, what if I missed that first elk? What if he just ran into the willows too, and now he's snuck into the crown land? Like he's worked his way through the willows. Or what if he's worked around behind me? And what if this is him? Because I when I shot, I knew he was a big 6 point that I'd shot at, but I didn't remember him being as big as this one.
Yeah.
But I'm watching and it was the ultimate devil on one shoulder and angel on the other shoulder, and the devil was saying, you missed that first elk, and now you've got this other elk that's standing right or walking along, doesn't know you're there, and he's just a wanker.
Yeah.
And the angel who I hunt with, a very ethical guy, former fish and wildlife officer, and I've got a lot of respect for him, and this angel looked a lot like Dave. and he's saying, well, no, you actually hit that. There was no reason for you to miss that elk. He went in the willows, and he's lying there dead. And there's no way in the world you can shoot this. Then the devil said, okay, so what if you shot this other one anyway, and then you found out you killed two? Surely you know somebody with a permit that you could. And all this is going through, but it was a non-starter. It was an absolute non. There was no way in the world I could shoot another elk. And sure enough, after half an hour or so, I watched this one disappear, went and he hopped the fence. Actually, and he was limping a bit, which also made me wonder if that was the one I'd shot at.
Oh, yeah.
So, but finally I just, you know, obviously I just thought, well, there's no way I can shoot a second elk before I know if I killed that first one. And sure enough, I went over and there's the first one lying there dead in the willows.
Yeah.
But we face decisions like that every time we hunt.
All the time.
And hunting, you know, more so maybe than fishing, although, you know, some people might catch a really big trout and think, I got to keep this trout, you know, like it's the biggest trout I've ever caught, without really thinking, well, you're not allowed to keep that trout, you know, by law. And so again, ego sometimes slips in and before you know it, you're, you know, but you just have to obviously, you know, be on guard and know, be aware of that. And making the right decision is always the right decision.
You know what the right decision is.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yes.
It's, but that, the number, myself included, the number of people I know who have been in that situation or a similar type situation where you're like, well, this or that or this, back and forth. Everybody that hunts has been in that situation at one point or another, right? Like, if you've done it long enough, like, it happens.
I had
a situation just this past year where I was hunting out, and I didn't do a lot of hunting this year. So the days I had out, I was thinking of your book, actually. I was like, I gotta take in the little things and enjoy. And I did. It was great. Oh. It was 6 days is all I did, and I usually do 20. 25. And I had this opportunity that I had followed in this herd of elk that had gone in with the snow. And earlier in the morning, we had heard World War III going off in the distance, right? And it was just chaos, right? And I was like, oh, that's weird. So around 10:30, the whole herd crossed this line, and doesn't happen. They usually leave before daylight, right? And I was like, okay, they must have been running from the gunshots. So I started following the tracks, and I'm looking downwind, because they'll do that. They'll go up and they'll turn kind of downwind and bed down somewhere where they can see their tracks, right?
Right.
And that's generally what happens. Not always, but that's generally what happens. And so I'm focusing most of my attention downwind as I'm going with binoculars, going slow, taking my time, really still hunting. And all of a sudden, about an hour into this still hunt, I come across, I feel this tingle on the back of my neck, right? I'm like, oh, shit. And look, right? And there's this massive bull elk staring 70 yards away, right? Looking at me. And I remember telling myself, I've been in this situation so many times now. And almost every time I just pull up and shoot, right? But by the time you pull up, they're gone, right? They've left. So I told myself in previous years, like, next time you're in this situation, you're going to stay still and you're going to wait until it turns its head, right? It might take 10 minutes and then you're going to pull up, right? And so that's what I did. I stood there and I waited about probably a minute and a half before he finally turned his head. And by the time I got the gun up, he was running away, and all I had was an ass shot, right? And I'm like, I'm not doing that. I have no interest. And so I bugled once, and I heard the crash, 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 and then I saw an elk's body stop somewhere, right? And I ran ahead, and I saw it stop, and I looked at it, and I could see the body. And I'm like, I was just about to shoot, and I was like, I don't know that's the bull. There's a whole herd in here somewhere.
Oh.
It could very easily be a cow. And I'm looking and I'm looking, looking for an antler. And finally he moves and I see the antler move, right? And I'm like, but I wasn't, at the same time, I would have killed myself if I had shot a cow or an illegal
exactly.
bull or something. But that it's hard though, because with that ethical side of it, right? Because sometimes you don't have time to even think about it. You just go,
oh,
you know what I mean? There's lots of stories of people I know who, you know, they shot a moose, and after the you know, there's three moose standing there or something, and they're all the same size. They shot one, and all of a sudden they two are gone, and they see one standing there, and they're like, oh, I must have missed, and they shoot again. Lo and behold, you shot two moose.
Yeah.
And it's like, oh, and nobody wants that. It's not, it's a blink of an eye, but you need to go through these processes in your mind almost before you go out and know, what am I going to do? You need to test yourself, because you need to know what your ethics are, because we're all trying to be as ethical as possible. But sometimes you just, if you haven't done that thought experiment or something, right? But it's easy to let that ego take over.
But it's hard to do a pretest.
It is super hard.
Because it's what's happening right now in the field before you pull that trigger.
Yeah.
I mean, and you can think about it at home or driving your truck on the way there. You can think of all kinds of scenarios. Okay, what if this happens? What would I do? You don't know until you're actually out there and you're faced with the situation, and then you're thinking, okay, is that an antler? You know, or is that not an antler? Is that, is that a female or is that a male, and you've only got a male tag or only got a female tag or whatever?
Like,
you know, a bird gets up, you know, is that a hen pheasant or is that a rooster pheasant? Like, you know, an early season rooster can look like a hen, right? It got a little tail and very little coloration. But we make so many snap decisions, but those decisions have to be based on what if I'm wrong?
Totally.
What if I'm wrong?
And And like, sure, we can't know what the situations are going to run into. I've run into situations where in a million years, I never would have thought I would have been in that situation.
Right.
But as hunters and anglers, we obsess over this craft, right? Yes. Like we think about it year round.
Oh, yeah.
Always, you're always talking about it. You run into a friend who's a hunter and angler, and that's all you're talking about.
Yeah.
And so we know inherently that it's a tricky thing. Hunting and fishing, right? And we know that it can test the limits of your morality.
Yeah.
And I don't think, like, accidents happen. Accidents happen. And that's inevitable. I think the best thing you can do if you accidentally do something wrong is you call Fish and Game, you say, hey, I messed up.
Yeah.
You're going to lose your tag for that year, but they're going to go so much easier on you than if they find out later.
Oh, exactly.
They're going to throw the book at you. Yes. And they tell you that. I've spoken to so many fish and wildlife officers that say the same thing. Like if you call us and you say, hey, I screwed this up. Yeah. You're going to get a fine. Yeah. But it's going to be as lenient as they can make it.
Yeah.
And you're going to be in good standing with those fish and wildlife officers because they know that you're an ethical person and you made a mistake and that sucks. But if you try to hide it and they find out, like they're going to do everything in their power to make sure that you pay.
You're hooped.
You're done. Yeah. Right. And you're going to feel so much better ethically if you go up and say, hey, I screwed this up, and you can sleep at night.
Yeah.
Right. Like I couldn't imagine. I've been fortunate enough to never, shoot two animals.
Yeah.
But I know people who have.
Oh yeah.
And it's really common. And I've been in situations where I almost did. Yeah. And not just that, but I have been in situations where I've wounded animals and they got away. And it's, but you feel horrible. It haunts you forever.
It haunts you forever.
The number of times a week that I go to lay in bed and I think about this one elk I wounded is, I did everything in my power. I made a poor shot. I waited 3 hours because I knew I made a poor shot and it was raining and it was and all these things. And even the next day I went in and I spent the whole week more or less in the area where I thought he might have bedded down and died. And even if the meat was no good, it's like I'm putting my tag on it and that's it. Because I don't want this hanging over my head. But I think about it a couple times a week. I go to bed at night and that's what I think about.
Yeah.
It's just bad. It sucks. It feels so
terrible. Yeah.
And you don't want that.
And no matter how many animals or birds that you shoot and you've done everything ethically and legally and cleanly, mm-hmm. We all hope for the one shot instant kill, mm-hmm. or a kill within, something dies within 100 yards. That's what we all hope for.
Yeah.
And when it doesn't happen like that, I don't know a hunter, especially a big game hunter who hasn't wounded an animal and had it wander away. A bird hunter who hasn't shot a bird and had it, broke a wing or something and had it run away, or a wounded duck swim away and get into the cattails and can't be found even with the best dog. Mm-hmm. These things happen and unfortunately it happens, but we just need to focus on trying to do the best we possibly can. Mm-hmm. And hopefully it doesn't happen regularly.
And I think if we're good and we make the moral decision of that's not a good shot, I shouldn't take that shot, there's a branch in the way, there's things you can do to minimize your risk where this shouldn't be happening to you every other year.
No.
You know what I mean?
No.
A couple times in your life hopefully that's all that happens, but we know that we shouldn't be taking a 600-yard shot, right? We know we shouldn't be taking a shot at an animal that's running away from us. We know we shouldn't be, Like we know if what you're doing is moral or not. And we can minimize, but that being said, I have a friend who took a shot at a bull elk this past winter, like a 90-yard shot. And for whatever reason, those mythical bull elk, they make you shoot high.
Yeah.
He gave it a haircut. There was no blood.
Yeah.
And it was fine. It was totally fine, but he missed. And it's like, that was a good shot. Like there was nothing wrong with that shot.
Oh, yeah.
He said he felt good. There was no buck fever. He felt calm about it, but he missed.
And a few inches lower,
it would have been hurt.
Bull would have just dropped.
Yeah. It would have been dead.
Yeah.
But it's so weird because we can definitely minimize our chances for screwing things up, but it still happens for whatever reason because we're human, we make error, guns off or whatever, right? Like it's, but we can minimize those errors and we can try to like we said, like you said before, right? We know.
Yes.
If you're trying to convince yourself of something, you did something wrong.
Yeah. I mean, and anybody who has ever watched hunting shows on television, on the outdoor channel or whatever.
It's not a lot of good.
You know, Wild TV. You know, there's so many shows that I just can't watch.
Yeah.
If they, they're making 800-900 yard shots, and I mean that's military sniper type range.
Those are rare people. Those are people that shoot 400 rounds a month.
Exactly. Yes. Yeah. And they've got the optics. They know how it works. I mean, for me, I would never dream of shooting anything.
Good Lord, no.
Further than 300 yards ever. Like,
because you know yourself, you know what your limitations are, right? What it is. We all have our limitations. We all have to work within those limitations,
and
set them. But we know them, right? Yes. Like we know what they are.
Yeah.
We know what we should and shouldn't do, and we know when we're pushing the boundary, right?
Yeah.
And I think that's one thing that like bow hunting has done a great deal of service to me is that it forces you to, after 1 year of hunting elk with a bow, I learned more than I've learned hunting elk
for
5 years with a rifle. Like it was just, you can't compare the two, right? Just because you're forced to get closer, you're forced to get, and you know you're not going to make a 90 yard shot with a bow. You're like, some people can, some people are that good and they practice. I knew I didn't. I knew my limit was 50 at best, if a perfect broadside shot. But we know what our limitations are, and we need to work within them. And
exactly.
Have some empathy for the animal too, right? Like don't let your ego drive how you do these things. Yeah.
Well, I mean, these are living creatures, and and as hunters, we owe it to these creatures to kill them quickly and cleanly. Yeah. And that means, as you say, shooting within our ability, shooting and knowing what we can do and what we can't do.
Yeah.
So no matter how big the animal is, or whether it's the last 5 minutes of the season and daylight's going quick and you've got to make this decision, you know, sometimes you just end the season and you haven't closed your tag on something. So
that was this year for me. Happens all the time. Lots of times, me too. Right? You got to spend a lot of time out there to be super successful.
Yeah.
Right. You got to dedicate a lot of time. It's not just a weekend thing, right? Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's a fascinating endeavor when you think about it, right? Like there's so many ups and downs when it comes to hunting, but I think we should all be aiming for that appreciation of just being out there, having the opportunity.
Right.
And appreciating the little things and just enjoying the moments, right?
Yeah.
And not being caught up in whether or not I'm like, work as hard as you want, do everything you need to do to try and be successful. But while you're doing that, try to enjoy it.
Yeah.
Because if it's all about results,
exactly.
You're not going to leave happy a lot of times.
Yeah. I mean, I think that goes for every outdoor pursuit. Like, I've sometimes driven hiking partners crazy. Because I want to stop and I want to look at things.
Yeah.
and they're more interested in getting from point A to point B in record time. Like, and to me, you know, moving fast isn't something I want to do when I'm hiking or snowshoeing or whatever it is. I want to be able to stop. And if I see something in the distance, I want to be able to pull my binoculars out and look at it to see if that dark spot is a moose, or whatever, you know, if an animal that I see on a distant hillside, you know, I want to identify it. If I see a glimpse of something small, I want to stop and watch and see if a weasel comes out of that hole that I thought it, you know, just went into. And it drives people crazy sometimes if they're result oriented or they're so competitive that they think, okay, we're on a,
that's me, man. That's me. That's me to a T. Like that's up until very recently in my life, results oriented. Like you were saying about hiking is a perfect example.
Yeah.
Like one of the moments for me, or one of the things that defines like wilderness and nature and stuff for me as a young child, was growing up with, I have family members in the Blackstone Wapiapi that are outfitters, hunting outfitters, right? And being out there with them when I'm 14, watching them work their asses off to get a sheep or to rally all the horses in the morning or whatever it is, was like motivating. It's like, oh, this is what hard work is, and this is what nature is, and this is beautiful, and this is where I want to be, right? But I think about, it was always about, for me at least, from my perception of it, was like, oh, look at how fast they can climb that hill. And because they live out there. That's their life, right? Yeah. They're mountain goats.
Yeah.
But I'm like, oh, I'm going to do that. So I defined a lot of my pursuits with, oh, I'm going to be the one who's like the fittest and the fastest,
right,
and the most competent in the bush. Right.
Yeah.
And it was this egotistical endeavor where I'm just like, I remember it carried into when I was doing wildfire firefighting, carried into that. Right. Like they called me colleagues called me Moose or whatever, because we're walking through swamp and I'm just giving her, right? And I'm just going, and they're all lagging behind, but not because they can't do what I'm just doing, but I see it in my head as I'm like, yeah, I'm fast, I'm competent, I know what I'm doing, but that's not what it was. It was just my ego being an asshole. Like, it was just unnecessary, right? But it's the ego can, like, yeah, it all comes back to that, right? Like, it's just enjoy the moment. There's so much to see. There's so much you're blowing by. Like, who knows how many things I missed because I was trying to do things quickly because I saw it as a competition rather than having the experience.
But in fairness too, though, Matt, I think, you know, I mean, outfitters, fishing guides, I mean, you know, these people make their living doing this stuff. Like, they can't take 3 hours to get to the top of that ridge.
No.
You know, they see something up there right now. They've got a goal.
Absolutely.
You know, fortunately, mm-hmm. I don't hunt for a living. I don't fish for a living. I don't hike for a living. Mm-hmm. Luckily, I've been able to do all those things as part of my living.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm a writer.
Yeah.
More than I'm a, you know.
It's your job to take in the things that other people
miss. It's my
miss.
Job to take this stuff in and describe this stuff and to share these experiences, mm-hmm. and to invite people in to, so they also can share them and come up with their own memories of their own times.
That's true.
And to me, that's my job. And I've been absolutely blessed for, you know, 40 plus years that I've been able to do this as part of my writing.
Yeah. Like,
you know, that this is,
you managed to pull it off for sure. Right, like you do a good job of noticing the things that other people miss and appreciating it, right? And like you said, there's something to be said for. And I wasn't really saying that you shouldn't work hard. Like, yeah, like you said, people are making a living at this. No, this is their job, and they're living in this area. They're noticing and appreciating the small things too, because it's there every single day.
Yeah,
they don't need to stop every 5 minutes to look at something because that's their commute.
Yeah, exactly.
You know what I mean? Like, they know they've done this a million times, and and I wasn't speaking and. What I was more saying was that I was motivated by their competence in the outdoors.
Yes,
to be, and I wanted to be that competent outdoorsman.
Yeah,
fully, right? And in the pursuit of that, I think I lost sight of the little things, and I became a results-oriented person. And I don't think it's bad; it's always bad, but it's just like I could have slowed. It wasn't my job.
Right.
I was doing this for me.
Yes.
I didn't need to push it. I didn't need to have a result necessarily, right?
Yeah.
And I found myself, the book definitely made me question how I do things a little bit, and it made me appreciate it, the little things a little more. And that's what I liked about it so much, right?
Yeah.
And it was great that way.
Yeah.
So one of the things I wanted to talk to you about was your friend Henry Bradley.
Right.
And so reading that chapter, and you can explain who he is and all this kind of stuff, but I got the sense that experience is kind of what got you started down the nature appreciation and the, you know what I mean? Wanting to be in nature and appreciating it and really understanding the connection of everything. Right. And there was the quote on his headstone: he was an outstanding trapper, conservationist. He lived harmoniously with man and the environment he loved.
Yeah.
And that was something that I was like, oh, that's living harmoniously with man and the environment he loved. I was like, that's a good, I like that. I like the way that was put. Because it says that, like, we need to live harmoniously with both, right? Like, being a hermit out in the middle of nowhere is not going to help much. And you need to share that experience somehow, but also not just you know, pillaging the landscape for the things that we want and trying to live harmoniously, be part of the ecology instead of this dominant force over it, right?
Yeah.
So I wanted to ask you, what are those, like those memories, those experiences, those places that defined nature for you and really drove and built your idea of wilderness? What were those first, you know, the things that you have in your head that, like, when you think wilderness, that's what pops up, right?
Okay. Well, I'll go back to Henry Bradley.
Yeah.
You talked about him. Henry Bradley was a farmer from Swan River region of Manitoba, and during the summer he would work up at a fishing camp at Elbow Lake, east of Cranberry Portage, in northern Manitoba, and he guided anglers up there. These were, for the most part, rich Americans who came in, and Henry would guide them. So I, very fortuitous, you know, part of my life was I applied for a job up there one summer when I was 17. Mm-hmm. And so in 1970, I think it was, and I worked up at the same camp, and I got to know Henry. Mm-hmm. and he was truly my mentor as far as, the ethics of conservation. Certainly I grew up hunting birds and fishing with my dad, who was more of a results oriented person, you know, like many people of that era. And that's not a knock against him. It's just, you know, the conservation, the ethics part of it, you know, wasn't as important as the numbers of fish we caught or birds we shot. And so I met Henry up there and spent the summer between grades 11 and 12. And we used to fish together. And he would talk about the fish, the importance of not, you know, yes, you're allowed to keep this many fish, but do you really need to keep that many fish? Like, if you're an American angler, yes, you do. You have to keep every... You know, you have to take home as many as you can legally take home, because that's why you're there. But for Henry, it was because he did have this farming background. He was a trapper in the winter up there, and a very good trapper and a very ethical trapper. And you know, he talked about all that stuff. He talked about the life of the forest. He talked about the need to conserve animals and to you know, almost farm the fur, you know, like not in the sense of having a fur farm or anything like that, but just, you know, that you harvest only enough and then you leave the rest to
not
replenish
your limits all the time.
You're
being sustainable.
So he was really pivotal in my life. And I think that's why that story, that part of my life, got the biggest chapter. In fact, I'm working on my fourth book right now, and it's about those experiences.
Nice.
Henry is at the forefront of this story, and a couple of, and after high school, when I graduated, I actually went up there one winter. I spent 5 weeks with him. On his trap line, staying in his little cabin at Elbow Lake, and he had a dog team, and it's just kind of amazing how that whole thing happened. But he would, you know, I would go out and I would check traps with him, and put up ice for that camp and another camp on that lake. Like putting up these massive blocks of ice and putting them in ice houses filled with sawdust for insulation. And it was just an absolutely incredible experience seeing wolves chasing caribou out on the ice. And Henry saying to me, why they do that? Because the caribou don't have the traction. And so the wolves would chase them out onto the ice. I didn't know that.
The hooves versus, you know, the pads.
The hooves versus the pads, exactly.
And caribou are just goofy animals when they're running anyways.
Yeah, so I left that winter, and and kind of, you know, knowing that I just had in the last couple of years a very integral part of my development as a conservationist and outdoors person, mm-hmm. spending an entire summer with him and then 5 weeks in January, February. And just learning so much and just, yeah. and a big part of Henry was just watching, you know, not talking. He wasn't a big talker. Mm-hmm. And he certainly wasn't, he didn't get on a pulpit and there's nothing wrong with people get on pulpits. But he didn't.
You don't have to apologize to me. It's okay. No. I do it all the time.
He didn't really hit you over the head with this stuff. He just would say, he would just talk about, you know, how wrong it is for fish and wildlife to have a late season, bull moose season, because it reduced the number of bulls and that would breed the cows of the next year. And like, it was just matter of fact to him. He just knew this stuff. And so I didn't see him when I left that winter. Mm-hmm. I would have ridden him a couple of times, you know, at Swan River once maybe, but years later, Sarah and I went back, our youngest daughter, and she was 15 or 16, and we went back and we spent just over a week up in that country, and including at the lodge, and that's when I noticed, that's when I saw the plaque. I didn't know Henry had died. Mm. I believe he was 62 when he died, you know, fairly young, and he had died of cancer. And since then, I've had the kind of the joy of talking to his family members, many of whom, including brothers and sisters, well into their 90s.
Oh, really?
You know, who have talked to me about him, and nephews and nieces and other friends that knew him, and game wardens who yeah. used to work with Henry, he was just such a big part of my development and my appreciation for conservation which really is just wise use of the resource. Mm-hmm. It's not zero use of the resource. It's wise use of the resource. That's mm-hmm. basically what conservation boils down to me in one short phrase.
Lots of people think of conservation as like put it behind a fence and leave it alone.
Yes. Yeah, exactly. And that's preservation.
That's not conservation.
He was, you know, I've certainly had other mentors. Since then, I've been blessed to have other people who I've looked up to, who have taught me things, but I've also noticed that those people also look at say hunting and fishing in a similar way to me, that they're not, you know, yes, they love to have meat in the freezer. You know, we all do. Wild meat.
Why you're out there. If you couldn't have the meat, you wouldn't be hunting or fishing. You wouldn't be doing it just to, yeah.
Yes. Yeah. Like people say, well, I gave up hunting and now I hunt with a camera. Sorry. That sounds great to you and I'm glad that makes you happy. But that's not hunting. That's photography. Mm-hmm. So don't ever use that in the same sentence. Like that's just, you're not fooling anybody.
Yeah.
You know, you're no better than I am.
Yeah.
You know, and in fact, there's been a lot of evidence showing that sometimes photographers actually stress an animal, you know, quite a bit because they're trying to get that ultimate picture and they're really in their faces and causing some stress and causing some danger both to themselves and the animals. So I don't have a lot of use for people who say things like that.
But it's coming from a holier than thou perspective whatever. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I just
don't need that.
You know, if you say now I like to take pictures of animals, I say, great. I'm glad for you. And one day maybe I won't want to hunt, mm-hmm. you know. And that day will come when I don't feel badly when I shoot an animal. Mm-hmm. Like when I shoot something now, I say a little prayer over that animal. I thank it. And I'm thankful for the entire experience. I think about it. I sometimes think, you know, 5 minutes ago that thing looked beautiful walking through the forest, and now it's lying there, you know, with a bullet hole in it, and I'm about to turn it into meat. Mm-hmm. But it's okay, because that's why I'm there. Like, it's not the only reason I'm there.
No,
but it's one of the reasons. Yeah. And if there wasn't a likelihood of taking home some venison, mm-hmm. I wouldn't be doing it.
Yeah.
So,
of course,
you know, if I was just going out there to carry a gun and walk around and say, "Isn't this beautiful?" I wouldn't do that. I'd leave the gun at home, you know. Like, yeah. And maybe
so the results are important.
And maybe
too,
one day, right? That will happen. You know, yeah. Maybe one day physically I won't be able to do it. Mm-hmm. One day mentally or spiritually I might think, you know, I'm kind of done.
Yeah.
But as long as I'm eating meat, I'd rather it come from a source that I really know.
Yeah.
And if I've had a hand in transforming that mm-hmm. animal into the our supper that's on our table, then I just fully appreciate that.
Big time. That's what I find too, right? Like every time I pull out venison that I've been a part of or family member's been a part of and I've been there for, there's more to it than just like, oh, you know what I mean? Like I'm not wasting a single scrap of that meat. Like it's all going to be used,
yes.
Right? It's not, this is full appreciation of the animal and like, yeah, it's, yeah, no, I'm all for it.
Yeah.
So would you say that those experiences with Henry, those were, that's where you built, like when you think wilderness, is that, going back to that question, is that where your mind goes, you think, initially? Like, I mean, obviously you have lots of experience since then. I'm sure you have other places, but I just think it's important. I think people who don't have, they don't have that experience, right? They've never been in a wilderness area. They've never had that, like, that spiritual experience of like, oh, this is nice, right?
Yeah.
They don't have that template for what wilderness is or what to appreciate. They might just see it as, oh, that's cold and hard and I'm tired and I'm whatever, right? And I think those people they just haven't had the opportunity to really appreciate it yet, right?
So
I wanted to know what your ideas of wilderness were and all that.
Well, I mean, wilderness to me can be my backyard when I want it to be, you know, like, but that was really my, you know, leading up to that, those experiences in Northern Manitoba, I'd never been in a truly wild place. Like, we'd hunted, a public forest east of, Winnipeg for grouse, rough grouse and spruce grouse. And yes, I guess that was wild land, but it was also, it wasn't untouched land. Like it wasn't,
by like industry and stuff like that.
Exactly. And the rivers primarily the lakes at that point when I was younger, you know, we really fished very little, you know, very few rivers or creeks, which I primarily do that now.
Yeah.
But it was really my introduction to wild land, mm-hmm. You know, wild creatures, mm-hmm. And you know the first place I heard wolves howl, you know, which anybody who's ever heard a wolf howl, just, you know, it's a life changing experience. Like if you'd have to be dead to not have, you know, the hair on the back of your neck just come up, and this chill is just such a primal, beautiful, incredibly moving sound.
I was going to use the same word. Primal is the word that came to mind. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, it just really is. And
it's like hearing a rattlesnake or something for the first time. You go, I know exactly what that is. And you just kind of, whoa.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's something else, eh?
Yeah. So yeah, Matt, that would have been kind of my introduction, mm-hmm. and that's when I really found that it really dawned on me, you know, my life has to include these types of places, mm-hmm. and whether that's, you know, going out to public land or private land that I've got access to, and, yeah, and where I can lose myself, and mm-hmm, and I don't see other people, or I don't see other buildings, and or if that means being in my backyard and just focusing on what's happening at the bird feeder,
yeah,
or just kind of losing yourself, you know, like turning your phone off. And And so many...
Turning the phone off is a big one.
Turn your phone off. And I think so many young people today, they don't have some of the same opportunities, mm-hmm, that I had. And yes, I made a lot of those happen. You know, I was the one who applied for the job to work at the Northern Manitoba camp because I wanted to do that. I wanted to get away from Winnipeg for a summer, and... Mm-hmm. And you know, I was the one who decided to go and try to visit Henry Bradley in the middle of the winter and at Elbow Lake and hop on a train and get a message to him on the radio.
Yeah.
You know,
that story of you. You had told him that you, in a letter, that you would be coming at some point, and you showed up, and he did or didn't know you were coming or something.
He didn't know it was me.
When
I left after that summer, he said, "Well, you have to come up and see me in the winter sometime." Mm-hmm. You know, and I said, "Oh, I'd love to do that. You know, how would I do that?" He said, "Well, what you'd have to do is, you know, probably get a message to me somehow. Write me a letter or something that the plane that did the monthly mail drops, you know, would drop for him, or somehow, you know, try to get a message to me." And then you'd have to take the train from Cranberry Portage to a little place called Hemming Lake, which was really just a lake in the middle of the wilderness. And he said, "There's a trapper there named Jack, and you know, and maybe you could stay with him, and then I'll meet you there." But this was all very nebulous. It was just weird. And so what had happened, Matt, was I went, I was out of work. I was done high school, and I was kind of figuring out what to do with my life. And I thought, well, I've always heard you can make good money if you go north and you go to Flin Flon or Thompson or something, and you work for the mine and you can make good money, and it'd be a good thing for a young single guy to do, and who, you know, who's trying to figure out his way in the world. And so I hopped on a Greyhound bus from Winnipeg and completely, you know, hardly any money. And I got off at Flin Flon and I went to the mine, and of course I didn't know about unions and stuff like this. And I went to the mine, and I said, "I was looking for a job." And they said, "Oh yeah, you know, what experience do you have? You know what?" And really they just weren't hiring. They weren't hiring kids who just got off the bus from Winnipeg. and knew nothing, really had no life experience. So then I thought, well, now what am I going to do? Well, maybe I'll take the bus down to Cranberry Portage and figure out how to get word out to Henry Bradley out at his cabin.
And this is what month again? This was the middle of...
This was January.
In northern Manitoba.
In northern Manitoba. And so I asked at the local cafe, I said, if I wanted to get word out to, you know, obviously I couldn't write a letter and, you know, sit there. I didn't have money to sit there for a month for him to get a letter and stuff. And I said, you know, if I wanted to get word out to this guy out at Elbow Lake, how would I do that? And they said, well, there's a local radio station.
How far away is Elbow Lake from where you are?
Well, Elbow Lake, 42 kilometers from Cranberry Portage.
Okay, but there's no roads there. This is all wilderness. No, there's probably 3 feet of snow.
I would have had to take a snowmobile and do the grassy river and then the first, second, third Cranberry Lakes, and then into Elbow Lake. And of course, it was winter, and I didn't have stuff with me. Like, I didn't have all the right stuff with me. Yeah. And so
you're at the
so
radio.
They said, well, but, you know, phone the radio station and maybe try to get word out. And so I thought, okay. And I forget what day this was, maybe a Monday.
This is amazing.
And the train going east and north was Wednesday. Mm-hmm. And so I thought, okay, well, I phoned the radio station and I said, I'm trying to get a message out to Henry Bradley, and it's live, like it's or maybe they tape it, but it's not the announcer saying this. It's, no, actually it was. I'm sorry, but Henry just happened to be sitting in his cabin, reading his Bible, and with his radio on in the background, like it always was, because he was by himself except for his dogs, his sled dogs, and he's hearing. This message is for Henry out at Elbow Lake, and he's going, wait a minute, I'm Henry out at Elbow Lake. And, you know, Bruce will be at Hemming Lake Landing Wednesday at, you know, 2 o'clock or whatever it was. And he's sitting there thinking, well, that's in a couple of days. Like, and who's this Bruce? You know, because it had been a year and a half, right, since I – and so, you know, like a – He knew a couple of Bruces. It didn't really dawn on him that I was the Bruce.
Yeah.
And so he next, you know, on Wednesday came and he early in the morning he packed up everything and he got his dogs ready and he hopped on the sled and it was I think a 13 or 14 kilometer through the on trails, like
this
through
sled
the forest.
Dog, though, right?
Sled dogs.
Sled dogs.
Yes.
This is not a snowmobile.
Not a snowmobile.
This is some old school. And he
was waiting. And of course, I'm on the train. But before I got on the day before, I phoned home and I talked to my dad. And I said, he said, what are you doing? Where are you? And I said, well, I'm in Cranberry Portage. And he said, I went to Flin Flon. I didn't get a job. And you know, I kind of felt like a bit of a loser because I thought everybody got a job when they went to Flin Flon. And so I phoned him and I said, can you do me a big favor and put my snowshoes and my parka and my .22 rifle and some shells on the bus, the Greyhound bus to Cranberry Portage? And he said, well, okay, you know. And so he did that. And so this duffel arrives and, of course, I open it and can you imagine sending a .22 rifle on a Greyhound bus now? Well, even a Greyhound bus, I mean, doesn't exist in Alberta anymore. But so I had all this stuff in a duffel. I bought some food, but not very much because I didn't have a whole lot of money with me. And to this day, I remember that my outdoor pants were blue jeans.
Yeah.
like what kind of idiot goes to spend any time outdoors in northern Manitoba or anywhere.
They didn't have Gore-Tex back then. And wool was expensive.
Well, Henry wore wool. He wore wool pants.
Wool was the way to go.
It was the way to go. So I got off the train, and for the whole train ride, it was about an hour and a half, I think. And I'm just sitting there thinking, what if nobody's there? Like, do I get off the train and hope that he arrives? Or what if he didn't get the message? And luckily, you know, the doors open, and the train stops, and it's like 40 below, like it's cold, and there's snow.
Legit
like,
cold.
Like really, really deep.
Is there a shelter there? Like, is there a train station?
There was no train station.
Just a stop.
I knew there was a cabin there.
Okay.
Or Henry had told me there, you know, this Jack, the trapper, had a cabin there. So
you know, worst case scenario, you could spend the night
I knew
with
there
Jack.
Was something that if there was nobody there, that hopefully it wouldn't be locked and I could go in and hopefully there'd be matches and wood and stuff.
Yeah.
But sure enough, Henry was there. And the first thing he said was, oh, so you're the Bruce who's coming to see me. And, you know, here's this long-haired, you know, guy from Winnipeg, didn't know anything really about anything. Yeah. And
as everybody didn't when they were 17.
Well, exactly. Well, I think at this point I was 18, right? And
so much wiser than 17.
Oh, much wiser. and so we spent that night in this trapper's cabin, and he fed us stew and tea. I think we might have had a whiskey at night, you know, and in our tea. And the next morning, Henry got his dogs going. We had a nice breakfast, and we hit the trail, this windy, meandering, you know, trail through the trees, and I'm in the sled, and then Henry stops the sled, and he says, okay, it's my turn to rest, and so I'm finding myself mushing these dogs. You know, I knew nothing about mushing, and I can barely hold on, and you're standing on the runners, and trying to hold this thing, and luckily the dogs knew more about it than I did.
They knew where they were going, I'm sure.
They knew where they were going. They'd done this route before, so, but all those experiences, like, just absolutely pivotal.
Yeah. Most people don't get that's a bananas story, and like most people aren't gonna get that opportunity. You know what I mean? To step off a train into a snowy blizzardy -40
yes.
with some
yes.
you know dude looks like he walked out of 1880 from yes. the fur trapping era
yeah.
with a sled dog team and all kinds. And you know what I mean? Like it's not that's so it's. So unlikely for yeah. anybody to have that experience.
Yeah. I mean, it wouldn't even make a good video game, right? Would it? Like, you know, like nobody's dying. You yeah. know, we're not battling, you know, legions of armies. And
yeah.
And unfortunately, so many young people today, they're caught up in more of a virtual world, right? That
lots of reward, immediate gratification.
Immediate gratification, exactly. Yeah. And I just... I guess I've always kind of felt that I had almost had a guardian angel, like, and who that was, you know, maybe it was my mom, like she died when I was 15, but you know what made Henry have his radio on that night loud enough that he heard it,
yeah,
you know what brought him safely on his dog team to Hemming Lake to meet me, you know what kept me alive up there, like coming when we took we actually took snowmobiles back to Cranberry Portage, and I was on the back of his snowmobile, and we started going through slushy areas in this one. Well, there were a couple of spots where suddenly the snowmobiles, because we were traveling over the lakes, and the snowmobile started falling, you know, falling through this slush.
Oh yeah,
and
some overflow.
Yeah, overflow yeah. And he's yelling at me to get off, and get to shore. And here I'm scrambling. You know, I had good boots and I had a good parka, but again, I had blue jeans with long johns on. They got soaked and frozen. Yeah. But it was on that trip that we saw wolves on the ice. We saw caribou on the ice. You know, we stopped and we looked at all this stuff. And how do you have experiences like that now? Like,
it's tough, man. You got to force it. You got to make it happen.
Well, you got to make it happen.
Yeah.
Yes.
Especially like that. Like, I think that's kind of my question to you was, how can people, like someone that maybe doesn't have, you know what I mean, wasn't born to a family that spends lots of time right. outdoors, or has never been hiking, has never been hunting or fishing, or even if you're not of the ilk that you don't want to hunt or fish, that's fine. But there's other ways to be out there and
right.
enjoy the outdoors, go camping and go hiking and go bird watching, go whatever, like sled dogging,
yeah,
whatever, cross country skiing. And, but how do you think someone can start to build those experiences without, you know what I mean, without having yeah. an easy way in, right? Like I'm sure everyone must have, most people will have like a friend or somebody that maybe can guide them, hopefully, but like say you didn't,
yeah,
right? Like how does someone go about doing that?
Well, I mean, there's organizations, scouting, you know, the Scouts, the Boy Scouts, you know, the Cubs, the Girl Guides, you know, like I know people involved in scouting in High River and outdoor adventures are a huge part of what they do.
Yeah.
And these are, for the most part, these organizations, they're everywhere. And they're taking young people into areas, you know, they might not be taking them to remote, you know, places in northern Manitoba or northern Alberta, but they're going to places that they wouldn't normally go.
Mm-hmm.
And fortunately, sometimes our schools, unfortunately, you know, one thing that often happens with our schools is outdoor programs are one of the first to get cut. You know, if there's cutbacks, and it's just an absolute shame, because to me, having that introduction to the outdoors through you know, whether it's scouting or junior forest wardens or school programs, outdoor education programs, or, you know, any of the programs that, that Fish and Wildlife, you know, offers and, and various, and the Alberta Fish and Game Association and other fish and game associations.
Yeah, the Alberta Conservation Association has
The Alberta, ACA for sure.
All kinds of stuff,
You know, so many people don't have that background. Mm-hmm. And whether you find your, you know, whether it's, it, you're a family in the traditional sense of the word, where there's, you know, a mother and a dad and a, you know, sometimes it, it just doesn't happen that way. And things, and, you know, our society has evolved. You know, we've got more single parent families now. And that single parent is often a woman who may or may not have had any kind of outdoor experience growing up.
Especially considering the like societal, you know what I mean? Like it wasn't something that was that women were doing a lot of because of the societal pressure to be whatever, right? So it's, like you said, it's less likely that they will have that opportunity as children to be exposed to that. So they may not have those values.
So I think people have to look at that and, and especially if their child is showing any kind of interest at all in seeing wild places, wild creatures, you know, if they're asking questions indicating that, that they might have an interest. And even if the parent or parents don't have that ability to do it themselves, I really think it's so important that they direct that child into a program and whether it's scouts or whatever. I mean, scouts as, you know, I was a cub, I was a scout and well, up you, to rovers and, and that,
you
that helped.
Junior forest wardens for a little while too, right?
You and yes, I was a lead, a junior forest warden leader in High River. And a lot of those people that were involved with that, they had no idea.
Yeah.
You know, sure, we had some, young people who, you know, they, they'd grown up doing this stuff. Mm-hmm. They were teaching me things, which was great. And you know, I always kept my open mind on this stuff. And if a young person said to me, Bruce, why are you doing it that way? Why don't you do it this way? You know, whatever it might be, starting a fire or whatever. I learned from them. And sure. But unfortunately, a lot of adults would say, well, you know, what do you know? You're just a kid. You know, like
ego, right? Ego, you know, again, afraid to be seen as
there's that ego again,
non-competent or whatever, right?
So I don't know. I think there's lots of opportunity. And I think sometimes parents have to be parents. And if that means saying to your child, okay, you've got half an hour a day on that device, and we're going to find other things for you to do for that, for the rest of the day. But that takes, strength.
It's
takes
hard.
Character.
Especially if you're a single parent, right?
Especially if you're a single
parent. I
can't
imagine. I'm lucky enough that my wife and I are together and we have a child and it's like, it's hard enough. A single parent, like I can't even imagine. Like, how do you do anything? Like it's, how do you shower? How do you go to the washroom? How do you, it's like, it's another level of, so I feel for those single parents because it's, they're super people. Like honestly, to pull that off, it's wild.
And I don't want to kind of minimize what they, or trivialize what the challenges they have when I say, you know, I just think it's up to all parents and, you know, whether they're single or they're part of a, you know, a traditional marriage or relationship, or non-traditional, or I mean, what's traditional now? Like, like there is nothing that's traditional, but I just think it's up to all of us to give our kids every opportunity to do things. And, you know, they're going to be the future stewards of the resource. And if they don't know what, you know, what it's like to be out there hiking and seeing, and seeing nice rivers and seeing lakes and seeing, wildlife. And if they don't know that, that they're not having an appreciation. I really like, Oh, there's a place just south of Calgary, the Cross Conservation Area, which I was lucky enough to write a book about in 2002, and they take kids from the city, many of whom are inner city kids, mm-hmm. with no opportunity. The only wildlife they might have ever seen in their life is a eastern gray squirrel running, you know, that's a non-native species from the eastern Canada that was, you know, brought here, you know, unwisely. Yeah. That's the only wildlife they'd ever seen in their lives is a eastern gray squirrel. And they've got an opportunity to go out to a 4,800 acre piece of natural land and see deer and coyotes and different scat and having to identify that and seeing different plants and bugs and see themselves as part of this web, yeah. this web of life. And until young people really understand that or even have an introduction into it.
Yeah.
But you've got to give them that introduction.
Isn't that fascinating that like we've created a reality for ourselves as human beings where you can say, oh, he's into the outdoors. And you're like, what do you mean into the outdoors? Yes. I was like, you know what I mean? Like the outdoors is everything. That's our world. That's where we live. Yeah. But we've managed to create our homes and our homes have become so centric in our lives that it's not just a place we go to rest and eat and sleep. It's become, this is where we do everything. And you go out to go to another building, to go do other stuff. But the, you know what I mean? The term, like the idea that people have to be into nature is like, it's hilarious to me. It's like, it's weird that we've created this reality for ourselves where we are separate than nature, even though we're completely dependent on it,
exactly.
right? Exactly. It's weird. And it makes me wonder, it brings up the question of, do you think that like there was a chapter in here where you were talking about you're taking advantage of bad quote unquote weather, right? So it was a cold snowy day or something, and you're like in the spring, and you're like, oh, let's go snowshoeing, where most people would stay home, watch a movie, and cuddle up, which is great. Like I enjoy doing that too. But as you said at the end of the chapter, right? Like you climbed to the top of this mountain or hill or whatever it was, and just a little ridge, a beautiful view. Yeah, with some friends and family, and you sat down and had a sandwich and some tea, and just enjoyed the vista. And someone said, "This is way better than staying at home watching TV."
Exactly,
and everyone agreed, right? And it's that brings out that emotion and that fulfillment instead of just entertainment.
Yeah,
you're getting that fulfillment of I did something, I saw something, I had the opportunity to wonder, to be involved with the ecology that is our world, and to
very much
So it makes me wonder if. Do you think that wonder, like that ability to take advantage of those opportunities, seize the moment or whatever, do you think that wonderment in nature is something that is inherent in people and that people nowadays a lot of times don't get the opportunity to recognize it? Or do you think it's something that there are just people like you and I that are, we're into the outdoors and we were always going to be into the outdoors and that's the way it was going to be and the other people are more interested in productivity and whatever?
Yeah.
I don't know.
I mean that's a great question, Matt. I wish I knew the right answer. The answer I want it to be is that everybody needs this. Everybody would want it if they knew it was there. Mm-hmm. You know, I've been with young people, whether it's at the Cross area or in Cubs or Scouts or. Junior forest wardens, whatever. I've been with young people who haven't had any opportunity and suddenly I see them experiencing wildlife or a beautiful place or a carpet of wildflowers on a meadow and they're just transfixed. Like they're just blown away. And these are people who haven't had that opportunity, but they know once they see it, what it means, to them. And if we can somehow, I wish I knew what the answer was. Like,
I don't think anybody does, but I thought you'd be an interesting guy to provide your own perspective on it anyways.
Yeah. I, I wish I was way smarter than I am. I wish I had that answer, but I think we really, you know, for our own sake, but for the sake of the resource, you know, we need people to know why it's important
and to dedicate their lives to
it. You know,
it, right?
Exactly. Yeah. So you know, we,
because it will be taken. Like if you don't have that appreciation, that fulfillment, that love of that thing,
well,
there's a good chance that as great as you know, the free market is, it's going to take advantages wherever it gets the opportunity, right? So you'll have complete development of an area or whatever,
right?
And so it's important to build those values, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, there's a reason why we don't build a McDonald's in a remote river valley, you know, and you know,
yeah.
I mean, and that reason goes beyond economics, you know, like it's the wrong thing to do. Like
everyone recognizes that. Yeah.
Yes. Yeah.
I think personally, I think that it is. I think everyone, given the opportunity, I think people who say who don't think they're into nature, or they think bugs are gross, or they think or whatever, right? I think they just haven't been given the opportunity to make it personal. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Oh yeah.
That's what I think. Like, yeah. I mean, we're primates, so the same as everything. Animals, the same as everything else. Like you look at the indigenous people, pre-colonization and stuff like that.
Yeah.
They lived harmoniously with the ecology of this landscape for millennia. Like, you know what I mean? For 13,000
exactly.
years or more since the Ice Age. And they managed to live harmoniously with, instead of trying to dominate and you know what I mean?
Right.
So
yes.
It's interesting. I think it's in our DNA to be part of nature, but we've gotten, I think nature's hard. It's difficult. It requires some sacrifice of some sweat or some time. You need to work to get those rewards. And I think we've fallen victim to this idea of comfort and immediate gratification. And just, I think comfort is the main word, right?
Yeah.
Like it's easy to be comfortable. It's, but it's not fulfilling. Right. And I'm not a mental health professional at all. Luckily, my wife is, so that helps.
Yes.
But it's, I feel like that disconnect from what's important, from what's living, from what's out there, providing the oxygen that we breathe,
right,
providing the water that we drink,
yes,
providing the food that we eat. I think that connection to that, I think when you lose that and you spend too much time in comfort, quote unquote, you lose part of what it means to be alive and part of the ecology and part of, you lose that connection. And I think it's easy to just fall victim to the dark places in our mind when, you know what I mean? Like, it's not, I don't think it's a, like some people might think it's a distraction thing. I don't see it as a distraction thing. I see it as you're recognizing the connections that you're not going to get watching TV or whatever.
Exactly.
Right?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, you see a house being built, mm-hmm, and a lot of people just see a house being built. Mm-hmm. You know, you in particular, because of the profession you're in, but mm-hmm, but anybody involved in the outdoors would think, okay, all that wood used to be trees. Mm-hmm. It's been logged. It's been hopefully logged ethically and responsibly, and mm-hmm, and it's provided jobs. And I think, you know, every part of our life, whether it's that, or we having a drink of water and without thinking where this water's come from, you know, it's
well, the water's, you know,
in Calgary,
too, right?
You know, the Elbow River,
yep,
Edmonton, North Saskatchewan, right, and the tributaries and the connections, as you say, it's just so important. I think that we give young people an opportunity to understand those connections.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
You know, And if we're not going to have outdoor education in our schools, then we've got to have some curriculum around that. You know, that you know, to me, that's just as important. Well, to me, it's way more important than knowing a lot of our Canadian history or the Spanish Inquisition or algebra. I mean, who knows algebra anyway, and or uses it? Like, I mean, and now I'm showing my bias and my weakness because I was horrible at that. But I would have rather somebody, you know, taught me how to. And luckily they did because I was in Cubs and, you know, so learning knots. But I'd like to know, you know, different kinds of trees. Mm-hmm. Like, it was neat to me when you and I first met and we came in here and there was a, you know, picture on the wall and I thought it was in some place in Alberta. And first thing you did was point out the cedar trees and point out that, you know, I hadn't seen that. I'd seen the water and I'd seen the waterfall and it looked like a place that I maybe knew in Alberta. But once you pointed that out, obviously it wasn't Alberta. Mm-hmm. So we need to be able to make these connections, I think. And
we all have the holes in our knowledge. Like, it's just a matter of, yeah.
Yes. Yeah. And it's just, you know, it's why you do what you do and I do what I do. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I'm constantly learning. Which is, I love.
That's how functioning adults are supposed to work, right?
Yes.
You're supposed to have an idea, acquire new data, change that idea, right? But
yes,
in this world of social media and everything else, we tend to, well, he's a flip-flopper. Doesn't, you know, he's not going to stick to his guns or whatever. And it's like, well, that's what you're supposed to do is you change your mind because you've learned something. But yeah, it's funny.
Exactly.
Anyway, getting off track.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
Yeah, it's one thing I found really interesting too. We kind of touched on a little bit was like the chapter you had regarding like your own mental health and your own struggles with, you know, and
with depression,
and with and just your way that you dealt with it, right? And so you said that. Like you had tried medication, you had tried other different things, and for whatever reason, and it had not worked for you. And that's not saying it doesn't work for lots of people, because like I have plenty of people in my life who have at one point or another taken medication, and it's helped them hugely.
Yes,
and so it's not for everybody, but it's just for you. You had mentioned that it was, how did you word it? You said a generous dose of.
I forget how I worded it.
How do you word it? It was the generous dose of nature,
healthy
dose.
Yeah, liberal dose of I self-medicate.
You said self-medicate.
I was talking to a group that was involved in addictions and it was women in this room and we were talking about mental health and because of course mental health is at the root of a lot of addiction related.
Poor mental health is, yeah.
Yes,
yeah.
Yes. And they were kind of surprised when I said that I also struggle with depression. We had been talking about mental health issues and they asked me kind of how I dealt with mine, because of course everybody's different. Mm-hmm. And I said I self-medicated. And which caused them to kind of look at each other nervously and, you know, thinking, well, with what? Like, and I just said, you know, with liberal doses of the outdoors, basically.
And then they probably all rolled their eyes.
Yeah, well, they did. And you know, but
look at this asshole. This outdoors is going to solve it. Yeah.
Well, exactly. And again, you know, I just realized in the previous 25 years or so that when I felt really badly, mentally, if I went and did something outdoors, and especially if that something didn't really require me to be competitive or that I was just going to go and enjoy and take in the entire experience.
Yeah.
And no matter what the activity might have been, that kind of at the center of it, whether it was hunting or fishing or hiking or snowshoeing or whatever it was, or just visiting a place to look at wildlife.
It's like that active versus passive participation kind of
very
thing,
very right? much.
Yeah.
And I would notice that I felt different about myself. I felt more hopeful but I certainly didn't, and I stressed this when I was talking to them, and I think I stressed it in the chapter too, that, and a lot of other people have written about kind of the benefits of being outdoors to our mental health. Mm-hmm. And Anne Frank, mm-hmm. I tell a story about Anne Frank and some of what she wrote, talking about, the issues, the challenges that she was facing, hiding in a room from the Germans and basically, what it meant to her, nature meant to her. And there's been far greater minds than mine. And I quote one of the psychologists, talking about the actual benefits of being outdoors. But again, as you said at the start, Matt, like for some people, counseling works, for some people, taking medication works, for some people, a combination of that. Mm-hmm. Exercise, like we, mm-hmm. It seems when, since I've kind of come to this realization myself, mm-hmm. as far as the contribution that the outdoors makes to my mental health, mm-hmm. I talk to runners and they just say, I run it, and that's what keeps me sane. Like that's what keeps me level, mm-hmm. and I work out or. Mm-hmm.
How can you expect I've always thought this, and it's just anecdotal. It's not. I have no proof of it, but it's just. I've always thought, how can you expect to have good mental health when you don't have good physical health?
Yes.
Right. Like it seems that if you're eating McDonald's every day and you're sedentary and you don't. You know what I mean? Like, how can you expect to have it be in a good place mentally? Like, it's just, I don't think it's, I don't know. And this, there's no science behind that as far as I know. It's just like, it's just my own anecdotal thoughts, but it's like, just, like you got to take care of yourself in every sense of the word. And mental health is a huge part of that, right? Like, it's,
No, that's so true. Mm-hmm. I mean, right now I'm not in the best of physical health. I'm definitely not an athlete. I'm carrying way too much weight and I'm still getting out.
You're active.
But would I feel better, a bunch of pounds lighter and so that I was able to do more stuff, definitely I would. So I'd say, you're absolutely right. They're both tied together.
I would think anyway.
Yes, very much.
But I feel the same way. Like I know for me, my wife laughs at me all the time because Christmas time's here, right? And we've got to go to the mall and go do stuff. And right now, my wife will tell you the same thing. It's there was a time and place where there was a time when I used to get physically ill going into a mall.
Yeah.
Because I don't know what it was about the people. And I'm not claustrophobic. I'm not socially anxious. I'm not. But something about all of those, it just seemed so anti-everything good. It's so pro me. You know what I mean? Like me, this, look what I got. And it grossed me out to the point where I would get headaches and and my wife would get so annoyed with me because I'd be walking around like a zombie, just this like sullen look on my face, be like, yeah, let's get it done. And I've since learned to like deal with that weakness in me and just like start to recognize that like, hey, you can make this a good thing. It doesn't have to be bad. That was my own just like being a baby. But I definitely know that when I'm go too long without, like you said, a healthy dose of the outdoors, and more importantly, one in which I can spend time alone in the outdoors and with my own thoughts, right? And not,
yes,
that's the important part for me, is it does affect my levels of stress and how I feel about myself and my family, my ability to be in the moment and actually enjoy the present right now. I spend so much time worrying and so much time thinking about the future and worrying about, like, you know what I mean, when you're driving, you're worrying about getting groceries and what do you got to do tomorrow. I got to send that email. I got to do this thing. And then when you're at home, when I get back to work, I got to do this. And then when you're at work, I got to get home we're never in the present. And I find stuff that's all encompassing, like hunting and fishing and those sort of things, it doesn't always happen, but it provides more of an opportunity, I find, to be in the moment.
Yes.
Right? For me, at least. And I got the sense from you from that chapter as well that was...
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think the key thing is you have to give yourself permission give yourself me time. Mm-hmm. And whether that's a day long hunting or fishing trip or a half day, mm-hmm. or whether it's 15 minutes, mm-hmm. Going for a walk in a natural area in your city, like luckily, you know, Edmonton blessed with an incredible river valley, mm-hmm. where you can basically just walk and walk and walk and get off the beaten path and sit by a riverbank and watch the,
Everybody has access to it, right? Even if you don't have the ability to go to the wilderness or whatever, you can go to the river valley. It's gorgeous.
Exactly.
You can see deer. You can see moose. You can see in Calgary, you'll have cougars. You'll have coyotes. You'll have, you know what I mean? So that is wilderness. It's just, it's within our city.
Oh, and I mean, the urban forest, I mean, the urban wilderness to me is incredibly valuable for that. Like, the thing is you need to be able to give yourself permission. Mm-hmm. Okay, I'm going to go there and I'm going to sit by, I love sitting and watching rather than, and I also like hiking and I like, you know, putting some distance on my boots and I love all that, but I also really like giving myself permission. I'm going to sit here, whether it's on a bench or just on the grass, and I'm going to watch the river. Mm-hmm. I'm going to watch the ducks. I'm going to look for rising fish. Mm-hmm. I'm going to see other birds, other wildlife. I'm going to watch a beaver, whatever it might be.
Yeah.
But I'm not going to be able to do that if I'm sitting in my living room watching the TV or playing a video game, which I never do, by the way, just because I
humble brag. Just kidding.
I just can't do it. And but I think it's really, really important that we take time for that. Mm-hmm. And
absolutely.
And you know, our big cities, so many of them do have mm-hmm. incredible amount of green space.
Yep.
And so enjoy it. I love when I'm out and about. If I'm out west, you know, in K country or somewhere, you know, in a place that I'm not expecting to see people, I'm almost disappointed when I see somebody else.
Yeah, totally.
When I do stuff like this in a city or in our little town, mm-hmm. and there's other people, I love it, mm-hmm. because I think good for them, mm-hmm. because they're seeing what's here and they're making a connection with their town or their city that a lot of people don't, and they're finding things that are just as important mm-hmm. to their health as and their way of life, their the richness of their life that mm-hmm. that's beyond, you know, the shopping that's available, the the other facilities, the rec centers, isn't it great when people look beyond and they see and they discover these natural areas, mm-hmm. and they're transformed, you know, like
for years growing up in Northern Alberta and growing up on an acreage where literally my backyard backed onto, I think it's about 130 kilometers straight south before you hit another road. Right.
That's
like,
amazing. It's just,
besides there's some logging roads and some cut lines and stuff, but it's like, I was very privileged in understanding the outdoors and the natural way of things. And so when I came to the city for university and that, and people would talk about the beauty of the river valley and how awesome it is, I would just kind of scoff and go like, that's not nature, like whatever. And I never really appreciated it until later when I started, you know, running and walking and just enjoying, just spending time and because no recognizing in myself that I'll be getting anxious and unhappy not being around more trees and whatever, right?
Right.
But it totally does it. You just have to go. It is a beautiful place, and it is, and like you, exactly like what you said. When you're out in walking in the park or something like that, and you see another person, you're like, that's too bad. But yeah, if you're downtown and you're in the river valley, you're like, it would almost go, look at all these people taking in this wonderful resource that we have so close to home, right? And yeah, I think that's an easy way for people to get out that don't have the opportunity to get out and enjoy nature and like go to Canadian Tire, pick up a fishing rigs and a fishing rod and read through it and go and fish the river. Like you can, there's walleye and you can catch sturgeon in North Saskatchewan. Yeah. Like it's, there's lots of ways to enjoy the outdoors while living in the city. You don't have to be. I mean, the wilderness, like, quote unquote, the wilderness, right? It's great and it's awesome and I love it, but it's
right.
It's not everyone has access.
No. And you might not be able to do that if all you have is half an hour at the end of your day or the start of your day or an hour or whatever.
For sure.
But to be able to bring that balance to your life, mm-hmm. that's just so important.
It is.
You know,
I agree.
But keeping your eyes open, keeping your ears open. Like, to me, it's all about all the senses. Like, it's not just seeing something, or it's not just, you know, as I said before, going from point A to point B. Mm-hmm. It's what you're going to see between those points. It, to me, is what's important.
Oh, yeah.
And what you're going to hear, and what you're going to smell. Mm-hmm. You know,
and the wonderment that you were talking about before, right? Like seeing a critter on the top of the snow and wondering, like, where does it go? How does it live? What does it do? How does it? That childlike intrigue is something that we lose as adults because we don't know for whatever reason, right? And I hope that that's something that everyone can start to we can bring that back, right? And it's something that I'm trying to bring back into my life is that appreciation for the quote mundane, right?
Exactly.
It's we so often think about the big picture, right? The politics of it, the economic purposes or reasons for something, and we so often forget about just like, why are we really doing this? Like, what's the actual reason? Like, this is it's interesting.
Exactly.
I appreciated this book for that specifically because it just, like I said, it was the first book I'd read, outdoor book, that's nice, like very, like you said, it's a conglomeration of a lifetime worth of work that you've done, right? Like these are all essays that you've prepared over, I'm guessing, a few decades, right?
Right.
And it comes out that this is, you've spent some serious time narrowing these down because they're short little 5-10 minute reads per chapter and their own little mini stories, but they get to the heart of the experience in a way that I don't hear many people capable of doing. So it was nice to, I could literally, like I said, I sat down in my bed and I'd read one chapter and I'd go, I want to keep reading, but I want to reflect on this a little bit.
Yeah.
This is nice. And it's a well put together book. And I congratulate you on that. It was super well done.
I really appreciate your words on that, Matt. Because you get this book.
I feel like you get
what I was trying to achieve in 36 little vignettes, basically, to take hundreds or thousands of pieces that I've written over the years and kind of find the ones that I think, you know, kind of celebrated the experience the best and reflected different experiences. You know, it was a challenge, but it was also fun to do.
Yeah, and I bet.
I wrote some things, you know, some stories just for the book. Mm. They hadn't been published previously in magazines and newspapers, and that part was, you know, I mean, it's fun when you can do a project like that, especially when people get it, like you have. And. And
I think a lot of people will.
Yeah. I mean, I've got a lot of feedback, a lot of written feedback, you know, the cards and letters and emails and phone calls and just people on that I've run into. And, you know, I did a talk in Medicine Hat, shortly after the book came out and I read the title story and, One Last Cast, which talked about a fishing trip that our eldest Chelsea and I had done before she went away to university. And I read that story and at the Medicine Hat Library and there was an older woman there and I noticed she was crying. Mm. And I asked if anybody had any questions and there were a couple of questions, but then this woman was crying and I felt very badly. And I And I asked if she was okay, and she said, you know, I'm just fine. Don't worry about me crying. She said, I just remembered when you're reading that story that I used to go fishing with my dad when he was alive, and he died when I was quite young. Mm-hmm. And she said, I had forgotten that. I had blocked that. Mm-hmm. And your story brought that out. And to me, that was, I mean, the fact that it had brought something out that had been a long time mm-hmm. parked mm-hmm. back in the back of her psyche and denial or whatever you want to call it. And, that made me so happy.
Yeah.
And you know, I was sorry for her tears, but I was glad that it had evoked a very special memory for her. And that's, if I can do that, you know, then I've been a success. And,
yeah,
you know, whether it's, you know, just a success, you know, success as a writer.
Like, yeah. Oh, I'd say so. Absolutely. Because you managed to make it in a way that people can really, even if you've never hunted or fished and you appreciate the outdoors and stuff, I think you managed to capture the feeling of it all, right? In a way that's very, it's easy reading. Like, you made it easy to read it, right?
Thank you.
It's not overcomplicated, or you're not trying to explain your ideas on anything. You're not trying to force, like, so many of the books that I read, right? Like, are you know what I mean, about like science and leadership and humanism and trying to be better. Yeah. And it's always like, these are my ideas on this thing.
Yeah.
Here, take them. Right. Instead of, this is just, you're like, hey, this is kind of what I did and what I thought and what I felt and what you think. And it's nice. It's well done, man. It's really, really good.
I really appreciate that. I just wanted to say very quickly that I've had people who have read it who haven't been, say, hunters or anglers. Mm. And even a reviewer in the Western Producer said, you know, I've always been against hunting. Mm. And she said, I'm not saying, having read this book, that I'm a real pro hunter, but I understand hunting more. And I really like hearing from people who say things like that I still don't totally agree with hunting, but I get it. I get it. I understand
it, right?
Why people do it. And your book helped me understand that. And
mm-hmm. providing perspective, right?
I love that.
Yeah. That's awesome. No, this is incredible. This is the longest I've ever recorded. We're coming up on 2 hours.
I know.
I could talk. I got so many other things we could discuss. And we should shut her down.
If you want to ask them and then edit everything out, I don't care.
No, I'm not gonna. It's so nice to have the full. I think everything was. It's good. It's good to go. One thing I would like you to do though, because we're gonna put that song at the end,
right?
Is just explain quickly the meaning behind the creek.
Okay, so
that chapter, right?
Yeah. So the book includes a story called The Creek that basically pays tribute to a small creek in southwestern Alberta. I don't name it in the book. I'm not going to name it now, but it's a place where my girls grew up camping, fishing. They basically learned how to fly fish on this creek. And we had many, many very fun family vacations on it. It's a creek I still fish regularly and camp at. Karen and I do, and the girls and I, you know, go back to it when we can. Mm-hmm. And so Sarah, our youngest Sarah, who is a musician, they're both musicians, but Sarah's part of a band called the Penny Farthings. And she, when the book came out in 2017, she wrote a song. She knew I'd done a story about the creek, and she wrote a song basically paying tribute to this creek, mm-hmm. and she called it The Creek, mm-hmm. the song, and it's really touching for me, because she talks about she talks about the importance of the creek to her as a place where she'll always be, mm-hmm. she'll always go back to this, and really what it means to her. So she recorded this with her bandmate and good friend Nadine Vroba. They're both they both live in Edmonton now. Mm. Sarah and Nadine and so she wrote and she performed it at the book launch, and she's since performed it at a number of places that we've been at, different concerts and whatnot, and it just really touches me that that this place where she grew up is still such a big part of who she is, and that she was motivated to write this song. Mm-hmm.
You nailed it, Dad.
But you know the lyrics of this song. You know that there is a place behind an open meadow green between back then and when, lost and lonely reverie. That's where I'll be. That's where I'll be. Heavy boots and muddy soil, line cast to the water blue. Looking once again, I wait to finally catch a glimpse of you. That's where I'll be. That's where I'll be. Frozen in place, I can't open my eyes. Breeze in the air, I know you still there. You are still there. Lost in this place I've known all my life, washing away the things I can't change. That's where I'll be. That's where I'll be. There is a place behind an open meadow green, between back then and when. Lost in distant memories, that's where I'll be. That's where I'll be.
It's a beautiful song. It is.
Yeah, I just, it's just.
She's got to be very proud of it.
Yeah, I mean, I'm incredibly proud of both our daughters, obviously, and you know they have carried on and continue to have the love of, you know, they don't hunt, but but they do fish and they just love being in the outdoors. They hike and they snowshoe and they camp and they just love being in the outdoors and so for that love to kind of, you know, be manifested in this song it's just such a blessing to me. I just feel so fortunate to have been given this opportunity. Mm. And you know about this, being a dad of a little girl, and whether you've got little girls or little boys, like, you love them and you want to do everything you possibly can for them. And the fact that I was able to share the things I love with them and that Karen and I did together. Mm-hmm. And, you know, some I did on my own with them, you know, and some we did as a couple. You know, I always found it's so magical to, you know, we often would not fish all together. You know, I would take one of the girls at a time and we'd fish or we'd backpack. We used to backpack into a little lake in Kananaskis country and I would have one or two nights with one girl and then Karen would come in with the other one and we'd trade off it was just so special to have this one-on-one time.
Absolutely.
And whether it was camping and fishing to rising brook trout or, you know, cooking over the open fire or, you know, later years, you know, snowshoeing, skiing.
Yeah.
Sarah did go hunting with me a few times, but you know, and that was great, but she knew it wasn't for her and that was fine.
Like, of course.
You know,
but you passed on your passion and your
yes,
you know what I mean. Like I think you accomplished what you were hoping to accomplish in what you care for and what you
yes
set. You know what I mean. You set your life up to pass on. And I think it's got to be one of the best gifts you can get to hear her put a poem and a song together like that. That's
very very much
does a great job of explaining the importance, right?
So. And I'd be very remiss, Matt, if I didn't say too that, you know, Chelsea's a United Church minister. She's often used in her sermons stories about our and her time in the outdoors, and you know, it's just, you know, for them to be able to use their experiences and their special times in other parts of their life now to explain to people, you know, whether it's through song or through through words. Mm-hmm. What this all means to them.
Yeah.
It's just huge.
It provides it's a real background of understanding for
yes.
a platform. Like it's a base of what to live your life by, right?
Yeah.
I love it.
No, very much.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
Well, so thanks a lot, man. This was a great conversation and we can do it forever, but I think people might get annoyed eventually.
Okay. Well, I really appreciate your time and your expertise and your interest and your passion, Matt.
Yeah. Thank you.
That really shows as well. So
thanks
so much.
It's just fun for me to get to talk to people that, you know, care for things and the way I hope people care for things, right? I love it. This has been great.
Yeah.
Thanks, man.
Thank you.
Thanks a lot for listening, guys. I hope you enjoyed that. I really, really love talking to Bruce. That was just awesome. A lot of the conversations I have on here, it's talking very specifically about, you know, the science and the research and the application of said research and science, you know, that kind of stuff. And so it was really awesome to get in a guy who can speak to the emotional connection to nature and to why it's important for society and just shooting the bull with a guy that knows what I'm talking about, right? And it's, it was really, really fun. His book is incredible. Definitely check it out. You guys are going to love it. Like I said, it's a bunch of different just short stories and you can just read through 5, 10, 15 minutes. You can get through one and just sit there and reflect on it. And you'll definitely get something out of it if you're a hunter or a fisherman, but even people who just enjoy the outdoors, if you're a hiker or whatever, get it. Please get it. One Last Cast, Reflections of an Outdoor Life. Check it out. And catch you guys next time. Take it easy. Thanks a lot for listening. Make sure to rate and review, all that good stuff. And I appreciate it. See ya.
That's where